didn't leave me any notes. No. Good evening. My name is Maria, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm getting this chair settled up here. I think I can still talk for 40 minutes, but I know I can't stand for 40 minutes. Can everybody hear me still, or do I need to move this mic around?
Let's go just a little bit.
Here we go. This will work.
You good?
Are we good? Okay. I'm going to start this timer here because I think it's really important that I get sober pretty early in this talk. It's a personal preference, and you know, I drank for a lot of years, but not that many compared to how many years I have sober today. So I got sober, I have a sobriety date. It's January 21st, 1980. It's my only one, and I'm really proud of it. Now, when I got sober, nobody thought that was going to take, but that's how it is. I have a sponsor. His name is Ray Paul. He's been my sponsor all of these years. He's got 54 years of sobriety now. He lives in Oxnard, and we still keep in touch. I also have two home groups. So I have a Sunday morning home group. It's Battery Chargers. We meet at 9 a.m. at the Kroc Center, and there are many of them here today to support me. They were one of the, when I came here, I was still employed, so that Sunday morning worked really well for me, and I walked in there. You'll know this is my MO, or you'll learn that anyhow. I walked in there in like August. They were looking for somebody to run an event in November. They didn't know me from Adam, but I raised my hand and said, oh, I can do that. Now, I don't know why they believed me. I actually was able to do that, but anyway, so I stuck, you know. And then in my second one, when I retired, I became a grateful member of the RAM group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet at 5107 Waring Avenue every morning at 7 a.m. And some of them showed up here tonight also. And for that, I'm really grateful. So before I get into my basics, which is what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now, I just have a couple of small kind of related topics that I would like to discuss. So it is a custom in this convention that the Thursday night speaker be a past chairman. And this year it would have been Jason's turn to be past chairman. But he's in the hospital undergoing medical treatments. Those who know his family, his story, or Heather, you know, will know what that's all about. But I'd like to take a moment to wish up a prayer for him. He's going through a lot, and so is she. So we'll take like, we'll try not a whole minute, but. And if you're at home and have and you're a prayer, I'm sure they could use as many of your prayers as you have to offer. So the other thing is I'd like to leave you with a little bit of really stupid trivia, because I think you should be able to get a little stupid trivia out of everything. So I'm not a big researcher. I don't have any notes. I didn't make a speech. I didn't run this whole thing through in my head and time it. I didn't do any of that stuff. But I did a little research because the theme this year is willingness is the key. And so what I discovered, for what it's worth, probably not much, is that the word willingness appears 33 times in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. However, the word willing appears in there 68 times. And what that kind of said to me is, you know, willing is the verb, and action is the requirement. If you want to stay in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, if you want to be sober one day at a time, then you need action. So willingness might be the key, but you're willing to go to any lengths. I can remember that line from way back when. So I was born into a normal family. My parents are not alcoholic. I have four siblings. None of them are alcoholic. I was just the one. And I believe personally that I was born across the invisible line of alcoholism. I believe I came into this world alcoholic. I didn't become a liar and a cheat and a thief till I was six. However, I didn't take up drinking till I was like 20. But, you know, I made some pretty alcoholic, what I consider, decisions in those non-alcoholic years. And, you know, the best one I think is that I don't know how you were as a teenager, but let me tell you, by the time I was 16, 17 years old, I seriously believe that my parents were the stupidest people in the world, and I just needed to get out because I was tired of all of their control and authority. Now, the problem with my decision was that my solution to that was that I enlisted in the United States Navy. Now, you don't have to have been in the Navy to know that if you're running from authority, the military is not really the place to go. But I thought it was a good place. You know, and the military is where I did cross paths with alcohol. Now, I don't blame my alcoholism on the Navy, because I seriously believe that somewhere in my life, my path would have crossed alcohol and I'd have been off and running. So just a brief synopsis of my military career. When you go into the military, I don't know how it is today, but we're talking decades ago, they gave you a bunch of tests to see what you were really good at. And I wrote well in things like mechanical aptitude. Now, I want you to know I didn't know a ball peen hammer from a Phillips head screwdriver, but I ended up going to a school to learn to be a flight simulator instructor. And the big deal about that was I was a first. That whole school was full of men, my very favorite subject. And it's just rigorous honesty. You know, and I'll tell you how full of men it was. So back when I was in the military, your Social Security number and your military ID were different. And your military ID had a big W hung at the back of it if you were a woman. But when I got sent to a military base to run a flight simulator in a training command, they A, put my billet in a men's barracks, because they had never had a woman in that. They just took it off of my my rating. You know, so I had to get that all straightened out. But, you know, and I walked into it. It's called a link shack. I walked into that link shack on a Monday morning, and I remember this and this man, Stan Gross, as if it were yesterday. And he took one look at me, and he said, "You are a girl." And I said, I'm an E2, if you know anything about the military. That's pretty near the bottom. And he's a chief petty officer, and I said, "Brilliant induction, chief." You know, and they did a lot that week to see if they could get rid of me, but I'm a really stubborn, pushy broad, and so that didn't work. And, you know, so I really enjoyed that. It was a career. I worked with men. I worked with pilots. I worked with men, you know. What can I tell you? You know, I went to school with men. I worked with men. Story of my life. But that also got me in a lot of trouble, and I eventually got discharged from the military under medical conditions. They called it pregnancy. Oh, that's what it was. But anyway, you know, and I moved on with my life. It was a turning point in my life, not necessarily good or bad. I eventually ended up back home with my parents, which is not a place to be when you're like 25 or 26 years old. You know, they still had a bunch of younger kids at home, and I didn't last there very long because my drinking habits really upset my parents. And what upset them is, and I can see now that I've had children, you know, I would go out at night and not come home till 2 o'clock in the morning. And they would worry, where in the hell is that woman? We know she's drunk and she's driving. So my solution to that problem was I got in a car and moved to Los Angeles, California. Everything I owned back then fit in 1967 Ford Mustang Fastback. Everything I owned. And I had $300 in cash. But I had a job out here, and, you know, I came out here, and I made a new life in California, but it didn't stop my drinking. But then again, I'm still pushing against that barrier. There were barriers back when I was in the 60s. Well, they're still there today. But I had a lot of training now as a flight simulator, you know, but the airlines just laughed at me. I mean, I had 30,000 log certified hours. They offered me a job as a clerk typist. I probably would have taken it had I been able to type. But anyhow, I ended up in a phone company, and I wanted to be like a technician. But my drawback was I was a girl. Now, I was fully qualified. I just had one small problem. I was a girl. You know, it took a few years, and I finally became a telephone installer for Pacific Bell. And that was a good job. But then again, I was the only girl and the very first girl in a telephone garage in Beverly Hills, California. I really liked that job, and I was there for several years until I had babies. Pole climbing and pregnancy don't really go too well together. But when I first got pregnant, I still stayed. I actually stayed till I was 8 months and a week because I wasn't climbing poles when I got pregnant, so they couldn't restrict me because I wasn't climbing poles. And that was the only thing I couldn't do at that time in my life. But I like to share this because this will catch up in my sobriety part of my story. Just before I got married, I was... trying to, I planned this grandiose wedding all by myself, of course, and all this stuff. And my doctors had given me a little sedative or something to help with my nerves. And I got in a small accident with my phone truck. The ladder of my phone truck, you remember this old green, I had one of those old green phone trucks with the big hangover ladders. This guy threw his moving van door out into, and I just picked it up with that ladder and dropped it. And I told the first foreman that I was on this medication, and he said, don't tell anyone. So I didn't, but I think he must have told the union, the shop steward, because the shop steward came to me and went with a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and wanted to talk about my drinking, and I told him he was crazy. So, you know, fast forward, I leave being a phone installer because now I'm having babies. You know, so I'm married, I'm having babies, I have a house, I have a husband, I have two babies, pretty one after the other, but I'm still drinking. And so the babies were born in 77 and 78, and the Christmas of 79 was quite a fiasco at my house. It was my last drunk Christmas. I used to try to buy your affection and stuff with money and things, and I also needed to drink, and I was really tired of being a stay-at-home drunk. So what I would do is I would put my kids in the car, and I would go to the mall in the daytime, and I would buy all this stuff for Christmas, and I would bring it home and leave it in the trunk. And then when my husband got home from work, I'd say, gotta go Christmas shopping, and I would go to the bar. And I could stay till midnight because Toys R Us was open that late. By that Christmas, I had so much stuff, it filled our entire living room. Now, I didn't live in a mansion, but it was still a decent-sized living room. And my husband left all the big stuff in the garage. But he also came to me that month and said, you know, the girls and I don't want to watch you die. So we're going, you know, either you get out of here or we're getting out of here. And I didn't like that solution. So a couple weeks later, on a weekend that I just, it was the first time I can remember I ever, no matter how hard I tried, could not drink long enough to take my kids to this event we were supposed to go to. I instead checked myself into it. It was a care unit back then. Now, I want everyone to know, the truth is, that was the last day I drank. But I didn't go there to get sober one day at a time. I didn't go there to come to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't go there to be of service. I went there to get that old man off my back, to get my act together so that when we went to court, I would get the kids and I would get the house. And I was there for, it was a 21-day program, just to let you know what I was like when I was new, that I was still very controlling and wanted to run everything. On day 19, they called me into the office. That's really how I felt about it. And they said to me, you know, Marie, some are sicker than others. And we really think you should stay a week extra. And I was pretty devastated, because by that time I was trying to tell them how to run the place. not the program, but like the food and all that kind of stuff. And so I decided to barter with them. I said, I'll make a deal. I said, you know, Valentine's Day is next week. If I stay, I'll be here for Valentine's Day. Now, I really didn't care, personally, that I wasn't going to spend Valentine's Day with my husband. But I made a big deal out of it. And so I said, I want to have a dance with records, for those of you who are old enough to remember those, you know, and some punch and some cupcakes or whatever. And they agreed. To this day, I have no idea. I wish I really knew why they said yes. But I like to share this story because I learned something very important on that thanks on that Valentine's Day. And what I learned was that I could dance without having alcohol in my system. Because I don't know how you were when you got here, but I thought, A, my life was over, I would never have any fun again, and I certainly wouldn't be able to do things like dance. And, you know, I had some people who were pretty irritated with me. I messed up the bowling league because I was in the hospital, and I thought that drinking improved my bowling, in case any of you wonder, it did not. I bowled much better when I was sober. Just how it is. So I went through their 28-day program, and on day 27, I overheard them talking, and what they were saying is, I don't really think we should discharge her. I don't give her 24 hours on the street. And I let them know that I heard them. And I went in, I remember poking this counselor literally in his chest and saying, I'll show you, you SOB, and I probably did use those exact words, when I have a year, I expect you to come to the speaker. You know, he wasn't even alcoholic. He was an Al-Anon. But anyway, I expect you to come to the speaker meeting and give me a cake. And he said, oh, yeah, sure, of course. Well, and let me tell you, at a year, I went back and got him and made him come to that speaker meeting to give me a cake. You know, but my real secret to that was not that I had, well, the big problem was I hadn't figured out I was really alcoholic. But my big secret to staying sober for a year, only not knowing I was really, really an alcoholic, was that I got into service immediately. People used to come to our hospital and drive us to meetings 3 or 4 days a week. And so I committed to going back to that hospital 3 and 4 times a week and picking up someone and taking them to the meeting. And I could actually put 3 of them in my car, and the one I got in the front seat was always someone I couldn't stand. So it was one of my very first lessons in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, you just do what you need to do. And, you know, service work really saved my ass. When I was 3 months sober, my Sunday night meeting had elections. I got elected co-secretary. The lady who was elected secretary called me that week, and she said, I'm never going back to that meeting again. It's all yours. I took that real literally. And I slowly removed people from other positions. I mean, it's just the truth, guys. It's what it was like. I became not only the secretary, I was the treasurer and the coffee maker and the literature person. And, you know, and that's not really what made me a dictator. Here's what made me a dictator, gang. I didn't hold elections. That will make you a dictator. So, but luckily, I had a sponsor, and he finally came to me. I had a little over a year sober and almost a year in that commitment. He said to me, you know, Marie, leadership in Alcoholics Anonymous is rotational. He said, we really need to have elections every 6 months. And so I did always listen to my sponsor, and we started having elections every 6 months, and I gave up all those positions. And then there were a lot of commitments for people to have. However, I still had some controlling, because I want you to know that I always made sure, although I was normally at that meeting, that I was there on the six-month election go-around to make sure they still had elections every 6 months, because I have control issues. I have a few left, but I've gotten rid of some of them. So I also like to have important jobs. So I eventually, I joined the convention committee. I want to tell you how that happened. When I got sober, even though I hadn't worked as a telephone installer now for several years, I called that union steward who had sat in my car with the big book in 1975. So this is 85 years later. I looked him up, I found him, I called him, and I told him that I was sober. I'd been sober 5 months when I called him, and I met him in a meeting. And a couple of weeks later, he called me and said, can you do this service commitment for me at the convention? And that's how I got into convention. I started doing service at conventions in 1981. Up until this year, well, even this year. From then to now, I've been on at least one convention committee a year, and sometimes 2 and 3. Because I not only did the San Fernando Valley AA convention where I got sober, when I got here, I transferred into this, well, I didn't transfer, it wasn't easy getting into here back then. No, you may not believe it today, because today we're pulling teeth to get volunteers. Back in the day, it was almost, here's how I felt anyhow, it was almost a secret society. I could hardly find out where they met. Anyway, but I've been on the Ventura Committee. I've been on the Southern California AA Committee. And I also was in the startup group for the Southern California H&I conferences. You know, so I have a lot of experience in a lot of different positions in conventions and stuff. And, you know, this year I don't have a commitment in anything, but God took care of that. So I had been asked to be a part of the Women's International Conference. So those of you who know me well know that women are not exactly my favorite people. As a whole. I don't go to women's meetings. I don't have a woman sponsor. You know, and I credit a lot of that to the fact that, you know, I worked in the Navy with men. I worked in the telephone company with men. You know, I worked in the FAA with all men. You know, that's my point. My area of expertise, men. isn't that a good area of expertise? You know, and I said, well, I'll take a little tiny job. And I was going to be like a co-chair of greeters or something. And I'm sitting in a meeting, and they said to me, the lady who's doing our Zoom has dropped out. We need someone to do Zoom. Now, I'm thinking, oh, I did the San Diego Spring Roundup Zoom when we had to go in 2000, you know, in COVID. I can do this because I thought it was the same job. Let me tell you, it was not. I did not look into what the position was. You can ask Momo. If it wasn't for her, we'd probably both still be dead today. That was a huge undertaking, not like anything I thought I was getting into. And I kind of laughed at myself, and I said, well, I guess God still wants me to be running something, you know. And I thought we did a really good job, but I certainly didn't do it by myself. You know, that's what I've learned from doing committee work all these years. I have never done any of it by myself. And I don't usually regress back into my drinking, but I left out this, what I consider a very funny story that I'd like to share about my drinking days. So when I was allowed to become a telephone installer for Pacific Bell at the time, first of all, I was 30 years old, so I want you to know those young guys thought I was an old person. They should see me now. Anyway, they thought I was a really old person. But I don't know how your drinking was, but with my drinking, if it was really, really important I stay sober, it was really, really almost impossible. So the weekend before pole climbing school started, I drank a lot, and I was not really all that well when I got up that Monday morning. So, you know, I got a couple of cans of beer, I got in the shower, you know, I got in my car, and I drove to pole climbing school. And it was really hot that day in Culver City. And so they gave us salt tablets and stuff, and we're climbing up and down these poles, and several times when I would come to the ground, I would have to go throw up. But I want you to know that I blamed it on the salt pills. It had nothing to do with my drinking. And, you know, that's how it always was in my drinking. It was always somebody else's. You know, and the other thing that was just before I got sober, I had been elected, I guess is the right word, the chairman of an all-male American Legion post at 20th Century Fox. And when I got, and that was a drinking event. When I got sober, I still had 6 months left in that commitment. Now, I'm a commitment-oriented person, so I want you to know that I finished that commitment 6 months with all of those people, and I didn't have to drink. And it's because I believe I was doing so much other service work. But it also shows you just how controlling I really am. But like I said, I also, you know, have held other service positions in AA. You know, I was director of H&I. I discovered one time that I was director of H&I and some other big commitment in the same year. And I'm thinking, are you crazy? You know, when I look back at some of the things that I leaped into, but I don't regret any of it. You know, I've learned not to regret my past. So, but let me tell you what really happened to my family and the house and the kids. So my husband, God rest his soul, because he passed a few years ago, and I had been divorced a long time at that. But anyway, he was still the father of my children. He believed that alcoholism was a primary disease and didn't affect people who didn't drink. So that I was the only person that had a problem. He seriously believed that. But I finally got him to go to an event with me, an AA event, and I overheard him talking to a lady about the fact that he would come home from work at night and I would be sitting in a chair pretty fairly underway in my drinking evening, and he would ask me, are you going to get up and make dinner? And I would say, of course I'm going to get up and make dinner. And I would get up out of that chair, and I would make a sharp turn, and I would smack the wall. Almost every time I would hit the wall before I got to the door. And so I heard her telling this story, and he said, but you know, I had come up with a solution. I was going to move the wall. He said, but I had to get the heater moved first. And I'm laughing, you know, and I'm laughing to myself and chuckling inside, and I'm thinking, this is what you think does not affect outside people? You know, our drinking affects everyone. It affects us different, but it affects everyone, you know. And we sometimes don't see it. We sometimes don't see it. But when I was about 8 years, I had to divorce that man. And I did a lot of thorough work on when I made that decision that this marriage was never, ever, ever going to work. And I did a fourth step on it. I did a lot of writing, I did a lot of talking, you know, and the decision I had made was that, A, as long as I hung around, that man was never going to find anybody who really cared for him. And B, I didn't want my little girls to think that married people all slept in different bedrooms. You know, because we had a four-bedroom house, and everybody had their own bedroom. I'm thinking, this is not right. But I can tell you, I believe that I had one of the most amicable divorces in the state of California. And part of it was because I had no desire to, A, run him through the coals financially. I didn't feel a need to do that. I didn't have to degrade him as a father of our children, because there was nothing wrong with his fathering. The things that had gone wrong was that when he met me and when he married me, I was a drunk, you know? And when I was no longer a drunk, I wasn't that person anymore. I wasn't that dependable. I wasn't that dependent. You know, I wasn't needy. I didn't have any of those things that apparently were the things that attracted him. And I say that because I watched the series of women that he dated and married afterwards. But I just, it's one of the, because you know what? One of the agreements I made with him was that, so I'm a little selfish around the edges, most of us are. So I wanted to make sure that I always had my children on Christmas. I had two little girls, they were like 7 and 8 when I got divorced. I wanted to make sure I had my children at Christmas. And so the deal I made with him is, I get the kids every Christmas, but you can come for breakfast and present opening and everything. And he was happy with that solution. And you know, and I didn't care, he came, he brought girlfriends, he finally remarried a long, long, I mean, by the time he remarried, our daughter had been married and had 3 children, but he remarried his high school sweetheart. That didn't work very well, but it was just one of those things. But, you know, that made it really easy. Like I said, I didn't take him financially. That made it really easy. You know, I never talked down to him. I didn't talk about him. And, you know, and I'm really grateful that I was able to do all of those things. And I didn't want any of his pension. I didn't want anything. I just wanted out. You know, and when I got out, I was so grateful. I knew that I had made the right decision. But I hadn't made it lightly, and I hadn't made it in anger. And I find that about the decisions that I have to make in my life today. You know, I try to make sure that I have a level mind, that I've looked at all sides. Because one of the things I've learned about, like, people stepping on toes, if you've stepped on my toes, the odds are really high that I've put my foot underneath yours. You know, I really have always been able to be responsible, I hope, for my own actions. You know, like I said, and I've done a lot of things during my recovery. Some of them were really good, and some of them were really stupid. But it really doesn't matter because they were all mine, you know. They're part of my life. There was like, I went to a convention in January of this year where the theme was turning points. And I tried to think about where were those really big turning points in my life, you know. And when we look back on them, sometimes what I've learned is that those turning points that we think maybe we made the wrong decision, or those things that happened to us that we think are really awful, can be some of the very best things that have ever happened to us. And my best example of that is that when I was working for the phone company, still in the business office, or back in the business office, because after I had those babies and went back to work for the phone company, by this time I was 40 and they were not interested in giving me a job climbing telephone poles. But there was this job that I really wanted. It was in tech. It was an IT job. Now, I would love to tell you I was fully qualified for it, but I wasn't. But I was very interested, and I spent a lot of time with those guys. And, like, if they all had to go somewhere, they would leave me in charge, like, if something had to be rebooted. So I knew a little. And I applied for that job more than once every time there was a vacancy. And finally, one time, I got it. But shortly after, they said, oh, yes, you can have this job. They came to me, and they said, well, you know, since you're not really qualified, we need to change the pay grade and re-advertise it. So then they did that, and I still got the job. But then about 2 days before I was supposed to start, they came to me and they said, oh, you know, Joe Smith lost his job, and now we're going to put him in that position. You have to go back and be a clerk. And this is like the difference between management and non-management. I was devastated. I was so, here I am, I'm a 40-some-year-old woman sitting in an office, the door closed, bawling my eyes out for 30 minutes because I didn't get this job. In retrospect, when I get to look back at that turning point in my life, the company outsourced all that work within 2 years, and none of those guys had jobs. And in the meanwhile, since they had to make me eligible for management, which they might not have done for any other management job they had. I ended up with a good paying management job at the phone company, which I kept for many years until I went to work for the FAA. You know, it increased my income, it increased my knowledge. I mean, it was the very best thing that could have happened to me. But when it was happening, it felt like the very worst thing. You know, so today I try to be much more careful when something hits me as like not fair or not going the way I want it. I have needed to learn that if I just be patient and wait for God, that I will learn that he's guiding me, that he's got the very best path for me in my life. And, you know, I didn't always believe that. I mean, I came to AA with religion, but I didn't come to AA with faith. You know, that's something I had to learn here in Alcoholics Anonymous, trust and faith in a loving God. Now, I don't really care what you call him or her or it. You know, like I said, I like the old joke, I prefer you don't use a doorknob, they'll turn on you, but, you know, that's a really old joke and probably should give it up. Anyhow, so, you know, I mean, those are the kind of things that that happened in my life. I have some miracles, I call them miracles anyhow, that have also happened in my recovery. So like I said, when I was in the military, I had a child that I put up for adoption. I just, you know, signed her over to Catholic Charities, walked away, and tried to start a new life. And, you know, I realized after a while that that was the very smartest thing I could have done. You know, it was another, she was born in 66, so it was another 14 years till I got sober. She and I would have probably both been dead by then. And so, you know, in a way I was grateful. But I would get divorced and all that kind of thing. I got married, I had two more kids. Which I wasn't sure would happen. I was sure God was going to punish me because I used to have that God when I drank. But anyway, I had two little girls. Now, the gentleman I married knew I had another child, but I certainly didn't tell those little girls. You know, you don't want to tell your, especially when they got to be teenagers, you don't want to tell them about how what your mother used to be like, you know. But so they're in their very, or my girls, the ones I raised, are like in their early 20s. And it's Memorial Day weekend, and this baby had been born on Memorial Day weekend. And so, for whatever reason, a lot of guilt and remorse and stuff had come over me, and I just burst into tears. We're sitting at the dining room table, and I'm crying like a crazy person. You know, and my kids were really concerned that there was something seriously wrong with me. I mean, there is something seriously wrong with me, but, you know, so I finally decided, you know, they were pretty old, that, you know, it was time that they could deal with that. You know, so I told them about this child that I had all those years ago, and my youngest said to me, can we try to find her? And I thought, well, I've tried once. It was a closed adoption state, yeah. So my daughter's really very good with the internet and stuff, but I still think this is pretty miraculous. Within 30 days, and that's a pretty short period of time, on a free website, my daughter was able to locate this child that I had given birth to like 36 years earlier. You know, and the strangest part about that was this child was, there were two adopted children in her family, and her younger sister had found her mother, and she was really insisted that Catherine, that's my daughter, find her mother. And so she was the one who was out looking. My daughter wasn't the one out looking. Her sister was out looking. So it was her sister and my child crossed paths. And, you know, it took a while for her to actually believe it was real. Now, she was born in a military hospital on a date. You know, how many children are born in Pensacola General Hospital to an unwed mother on any given day? Probably not more than one. But anyhow, and even when we exchanged pictures, and my mother, my personal mother almost cried when I got a picture of her in second grade, and I have a picture of me in second grade, and you could hardly tell them apart, you know. But she still, it took us some time. Her adopted mother had to go to Catholic Charities and practically beat on them to get them to open up the adoption records so this child could see the actual birth certificate. And so one day, I had to get on an airplane in Burbank, California, or at least I chose to, and fly to Atlanta, Georgia to meet this child that I hadn't seen for 36 years. And I had to do it sober, of course, because she had a lot of questions that I didn't want to answer on the phone. And so I did that. You know, and she made some comment about her drinking. But let me tell you, when I got there, she, like my other children, are nowhere near alcoholic. You know, and I'm grateful for that reunion. You know, we keep in touch. I know what's going on in her life. You know, I'm grateful for the parents that she had. But it's not the same. If you're on either side of that, if you're adopted or if you've adopted kids, it's just not the same. You know, I didn't raise her. Her standards and her morals and stuff are way different from the children I raised, you know. But she's mine, and I'm really glad I found her, and I thought it was really pretty miraculous, you know. So fast forward. So I said I have two other children. My youngest married her high school sweetheart, and he was in the military. And that's how we ended up in San Diego. She ended up here first. They were stationed here. When he got out of the military, she sent me and she maybe called me. I was before internet. She called me and said, "We're not coming back to the San Fernando Valley. We don't want to raise children in Los Angeles." You know, so they stayed here and I stayed in LA and I worked. And she had a beautiful little baby finally. And because she has a lot of trouble having babies. I, on the other hand, probably could have had 1,000 if I wasn't careful. My doctor told me that, you know. So they're living here. I'm living in the San Fernando Valley. By this time, I've retired from the phone company, and I'm working for a company called Harris. It's called L3 Harris now, on a big government contract for the Federal Aviation Administration. And they don't have jobs. We didn't have any jobs in San Diego. My particular section of this company had zero jobs in San Diego. Now my daughter's getting ready to have a second child, and I'm saying, you know, God, it would be really nice if I had a job in San Diego. My company and the FAA decided they want to try this new experimental thing. The job position was here in San Diego, and I was the only person in my company who could afford to take the job and was fully qualified. Because the guy on the East Coast didn't want to come live here in California, you know. So my company moved me from the San Fernando Valley to here, paid all my expenses, paid me per diem for 4 months. Because in 2008, that's how long it took to find a house to buy. And yet, like I said, when I started with that prayer to God, There was not even a job, you know, not even a job. And yet it just kind of like materialized, you know. So now sometimes if I really want something, you know, I throw it out to the wind, which I call God, to see just what kind of miracles he'll perform in my life. Because over all these years, he has performed them all. And, you know, I've been very blessed in so many ways. Like I said, I have three children. They were all girls. I have three grandchildren. Two of them are boys. And then I have a little granddaughter. She's 11, going on 40, if any of you have that child. If any of you know that child, she's very, very mature. And they had rented, this is an idea of how much, they had rented some kind of movie on Netflix. And I said, do you think, you know, maybe, you know, we can, since we have the same Netflix account, I'll be able to see that. And my 11-year-old granddaughter said, you know, Grandma, it was some horror film. You know, Grandma, that's not a good movie for you. You know, she can figure that out. That's not a good movie for you. You know, she has become obsessed with Hamilton. She's into theater. She's become obsessed with Hamilton. She's watched that show so many times. She can sing the entire 2+ hours of Hamilton, end to end, word for word. You know, and she's really pretty. They're pretty smart kids. My oldest, okay, God, we're not ready yet. We're not done yet, God. Let me have a voice back. My oldest is a junior at Purdue University in West Lafayette, Illinois. He's studying agricultural engineering. He's going to work this summer for the John Deere Corporation in some little teeny tiny town in Wisconsin. And it'll be his first time ever anywhere, like all by himself. And the town, when I say teeny tiny, the population of Purdue is 65,000 students. The population of this town is 4,000. The square mile of this town is like four, you know, and I'm thinking this is good. But, you know, it has a lot of things that my grandson is really interested in because they have like a big swamp and wildland there, and they have bike trails and hiking trails. And, you know, I think it's just really geared for him. But I want you to know, and you probably don't, that John Deere has really great, what are those things called? No, well, they have those, but when you just go for the summer, internships. Yeah, some of those words take a long time getting from back here to here these days. You know, so it's a really neat internship. You know, it pays a salary way more than the minimum wage here in San Diego. It comes with housing. It comes with gym benefits. It comes with extra money in case you want to get a personal trainer. I thought, you know, you really lucked out there, kid. But you know, it's because he works hard. You know, and then I have one that's in high school that did about a 180 turn about, like, a year ago. I worried about him a lot when he was in 10th grade. He got in trouble a lot, you know, but none of them are drinking. I seem to keep, knock on wood, that for my recessed alcoholic gene has not been passed on, at least to the generations that I can see. You know, I really can't ask for much more than that. God has given me a really good life. It's taken a small turn on me in the last 2 years. You know, my health is not what I really would like it to be. I was used to be the kind of person, somebody was telling me how many steps they already had today. That used to be me. You know, let's start at 6 a.m. in the morning and run around all day and stay up till midnight or 1 o'clock and then go get 2-3 hours of sleep and then jump back up and work. And, you know, now I got this mobility scooter back here just so I can get from my room to the meeting. I have this chair because I can't stand for 40 minutes. But, you know, I'm really grateful for the things that I still have. My brain is still basically sharp as a tack, you know. My mouth still works. Everyone will tell you that, you know. I can talk and talk. It's really easy to talk about me for 40 minutes, you know. You know, but I'm so grateful to the things that I've learned in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, to the people that I met in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, one of the hardest adjustments to my new lifestyle, and we'll just have to call it that, is that I'm the person that was always, excuse me, I can do that myself. Get out of my way. I don't need you. I don't need a man, except for a few things. I don't need a man. You know, I can take out my own trash cans. I can take out your trash cans, you know. I'm smart. I can, you know, I can fix this. I have a daughter who's really good at the fixing things. But it's not that way anymore. You know, it's become a task. And I've had to allow people to help me. And that has been a very difficult thing for me to accomplish. I mean, it's like it's a new phase of my life. And, you know, saying, like I called my friend the other day and I said, I just can't get up enough energy and enthusiasm to pack for this convention that I'm really happy to be coming to. Can you come over and kind of like babysit me? And they said, yes, you know, or can you come take me to Costco? Now, I like to go to Costco once in a while, but I can't just get in my car and jump over there now because I have to use one of those little mobility things inside Costco. It's a big store, you know, and then because I worry a lot about parking, you know. But my kids come, they take me to the movies every now and then, you know, because I can still do things. I just need to find new and different ways to do them. You know, I order my groceries delivered to my house so that, I, you know, because running around a grocery store is not something that seems like really a wonderful, productive thing for me to do. And I'm really careful. I spend a lot of time making sure that whatever I do, I don't fall. Because I want to be able to ride around on that mobility scooter, you know. But I tell you, I still get up every morning. I get showered, I get dressed, I get in my car, and I drive to my 7 a.m. meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, sit down, and sometimes shut up and try to listen, you know, because that's really important. And, you know, and it's a marker for me. You know, it's a thing I can still do for myself. Because I can drive really well, because like you can see, I can sit here and talk. When I'm sitting, I don't know that I have a problem. It's when I try to walk around, when I try to come mobile, it doesn't work anymore. And so what I'd like you to learn from that is, you know, if you're young and you're still full of vim and vigor, go do everything you absolutely want to do. Because God is not going to guarantee you that you get to have the best of health. You know, we all have an exit plan. We don't get to pick it, you know. That's what I've learned, you know. And the other thing is that I'm becoming more comfortable with letting people know that I'm not really very healthy. Because for a long time, I wanted to hide that. I didn't want you to know I was not quite as capable of doing things anymore. And I know that's one of those things that many of us have. It was pride and ego, you know. But I have the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Today I have people who I know love me dearly. And I tell you, before I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't think there were people like that. You know, I don't think there were people like that. I must be really short. So guess what, guys? You lucked out. You survived the entire talk. And thank you.